The dip in so-called full spectrum readiness, the ability to respond effectively to a wide array of warfighting scenarios, is due in part to the military's long engagement in counterinsurgency operations, plus what Work calls the gut punch military readiness suffered when sequestration first hit in 2013, almost instantly grounding combat squadrons and stopping training rotations. Those factors, combined with an operational tempo that's still high, means the Army and Navy won't achieve the readiness levels their leaders think they need until 2020, even if Congress agrees to fund DoD at the levels it's requested, and the Air Force won't achieve a full readiness recovery until 2023.
Let me make sure everybody understands that. Our forward deployed forces are locked, cocked, and ready to go. But the surge force, the heavy duty Sunday punch that you throw when necessary, that's not as ready as it's been in the past. There's no question about it. And this is something that troubles us very much.
Work says it's vital that Congress repeal sequestration and says it would be a, quote, unmitigated disaster for the military if the original budget caps were allowed to return in 2016. But he also cautioned that at this point, the readiness recovery is almost as much of a time problem as a money problem. To help hasten the recovery, DoD has made some changes in this year's budget, including by slowing down the Army drawdown plans the department announced last year. For instance, the active duty Army would still shrink from 490,000 to 450,000 soldiers, but instead of finishing the process in 2017, DoD would stretch it out into 2018.
And that's to allow less personnel turbulence in the combat units. That will help near-term readiness. We added money to home station training, so that the forces that are home would be able to get to the ranges and get the training they needed. And we invested in our range infrastructure, which is very, very important for us to maintain highly ready forces. We also added funding to reduce the maintenance backlog. Each of the services' O&M accounts, operations, maintenance, or readiness accounts, increased by nearly 10% over last year. But we concluded that you can't put too much more money at this problem, because as you go towards full spectrum combat readiness, it takes time. These gains are very fragile.
Fragile because many of the military's training institutions are calibrated in such a way that they're not able to surge much excess capacity to process units through, almost irrespective of how much money's available in a given year's budget. In the Army, for example, officials think each of their brigade combat teams need to cycle through the National Training Center at least twice before they're at a state of full spectrum readiness.
By that time, all of your junior leaders, junior officers, mid-level officers, senior officers have worked together, understand the problem, can work together, and be very effective. Well, we're maxed out. We can only send 19 BCTs per year to the National Training Center. So money is not going to help that. It will take some time.
And in the Navy and Air Force, the end of official combat operations in Afghanistan won't have much of an effect on the demand for those services' forces, especially in U.S. Central Command and U.S. Pacific Command.
Those two demand signals remain very high. So the aerospace and naval forces are out and about, and they're not spending enough time at home station to get all of the training done before deploying. So even if Congress gets rid of sequestration and gives us the full President's budget level, it's going to take until 2020 for the Army, Marines, and Navy to get back to full spectrum combat readiness, and it's going to take the Air Force until 2023. Now, when you hear that, you say, holy crap! Well, this is bad. What do we do? But I'd like you to think back to Vietnam, another very long war, which was really had a big impact on our forces. And I would argue, after the ground forces came out of Vietnam in 1970, and after our aerospace and Navy forces essentially stopped combat operations in 1972, it probably took until 1985, 1986, 1987 for us to regain full spectrum combat readiness. Now, I grant that at that point we were shifting from a draft service to an all-volunteer service, which made the transition a little longer. But I would say that we need to just stick at it. Readiness is something you just keep at it.
That's not to say money isn't important. The department consistently maintains that it needs a budget that increases at least 1 to 3% each year in order to keep a balance in spending between acquisition programs, personnel spending, and readiness, and budgets have been essentially flat for the past 3 years. Work insisted DOD has done what it can internally to find efficiencies so that it can achieve that balance within its own budget, but most of the restructuring it's been able to do involves changes that won't pay off within a year or two. And he complained that Congress frequently stands in the way of those efforts anyhow.
They denied the Air Force their ability to completely divest themselves of the A-10. They denied the Navy's ability to put 11 cruisers in deferred modernization so that we would be able to keep 11 cruisers in the fleet into the 2040s. They denied the Army's Aviation Restructure Initiative. And even though we've reduced our force, and we continue to reduce our force, Congress continues to reject our repeated requests for a base realignment and closure, or BRAC round. Now, we project conservatively that that would save us about $2 billion a year recurring. Yes, it's going to cost money up front, but $2 billion recurring is $10 billion across the five-year defense plan. That's a lot of modernization, I will tell you. In this environment, it is real money. Maintaining outdated and duplicative systems and unwanted infrastructure drains scarce resources that should go elsewhere into the program. It is wasteful, it's strategically unsound, and it ultimately endangers the readiness of our men and women in uniform.
In upcoming budget hearings, DOD will also press its case for a new offset strategy designed to help the U.S. regain the technological advantages the department's leaders think has been waning as China and Russia pour more money into their military budgets. Work described a defense plan based on the 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review that would spend more on advanced communications and munitions, cyber, defending satellites from attack, and missile defense. He says the offset strategy would work in phases. Leaders want to start research and development now for technologies that won't pay off for another decade, but in the meantime, they also want to fund programs that can boost the U.S. technological edge right away, including by fusing new commercial-based technologies with existing systems.
So you'll see in the FY16 budget some really potentially game-changing technologies that we think can more quickly get to the force. And you'll see more long-range research efforts. For example, we're investing more in unmanned underwater vehicles, high-speed strike weapons, rail guns, and high-energy lasers.
Work says the third offset strategy will have to be different than the first two, which were based almost entirely on the fact that the U.S. built better technologies before any of its rivals. This time, everyone has access to essentially the same global technological base, so any advantage to be gained will have to come from whoever integrates those capabilities together into effective operational concepts and systems.
So a big part of the third offset strategies is to find new innovative ways to employ promising technologies. So I'll give you an example of using the Block 4 Tomahawk in an anti-ship role. It's a missile that's proven. It is an awesome missile. It has enormous capabilities. But just a few weeks ago, the USS Kidd, one of our guided missile destroyers, launched a Tomahawk missile that changed course mid-flight and struck a moving ship after being cued by an aircraft. Now, this is potentially a game-changing capability for not a lot of cost. It's a 1,000-mile anti-ship cruise missile. It can be used from practically our entire surface and submarine fleet. What happens if we take another step and just make an advanced seeker on the Tomahawk rather than building a new missile? We believe if we make decisions like that, that we will be able to outturn potential adversaries and maintain our technological superiority.
In Washington, Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.